Hello and welcome. We're back with another episode of Don't Miss a Beat, and I'm very happy to be here live at the Heart Failure Society meeting in Cleveland, Ohio this year. I'm, of course, joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Muthu Vaidyanathan from Brigham and Women's, and we have a very special guest with us today. It's my other friend and colleague from Duke University, Dr. Murat Fudim, who will be presenting as a late breaker trial at HFSA the results of the Rebalance Heart Failure Study. So thanks so much for joining us today, Murat.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
So I've heard you, you know, we work at the same institution. I've heard you, you know, explain the concept of splanchnic nerve block for heart failure, really innovative, novel concept. But for our viewers, can you just go over the basic concept and why this study was so important?
Yeah, the concept was really born by the fact that the common principle that we were taught in our med school and from our textbooks that cardiac decompensation is really driven by a volume retention process. That's why we use a lot of diuretics, for example. And when people go to hospitals, we diurese the crap out of them, right? So the reality, though, is that preceding heart failure hospitalization, we actually don't have patients, in average, gain any weight. If that is a surrogate of volume retention, 50% gain weight, 50% don't gain weight. So that clearly there's a phenotype of patients that have congestion as a surrogate, for example, with elevated neck veins. I'm not arguing about the fact that patients get hospitals that have elevated neck veins, high filling pressures. We know for a fact from pressure sensors data, like cardiomyopathy, preceding heart failure, patient cough. So pressure goes up, but volume doesn't sum. Where does it come from? So the concept of volume distribution was born. Very simple concept. The idea here is that, think of it like a bottle trick. If you squeeze the bottle, that bottle was not filled up with any water. It shifts blood north. That is what the concept of distribution might induce in the chest as a pressure overloaded state. But it's not a volume overloaded state. That squeeze, that thumb of mine, is the sympathetic nervous system, that stress fight or flight system. It can be acute within seconds, or it can be chronic over weeks, months. That's how we believe it can work. Well, the nerve that supplies all the fibers to the abdominal cavity is exclusively running through the so-called splanchnic nerve. And there are six of them. But the biggest one is the so-called greater splanchnic nerve, referred to as GSN, greater splanchnic nerve. There are two of them, one on the right and one on the left. And now, you know, we have, and you were part of those studies and probably maybe referred to patients willingly or unwillingly, we have done a series of studies, and there were open label, single arm studies where we've done, just to make sure that it's safe and feasible, we block those nerves with anesthetics, lidocaine, ropivacaine, and then we went to Botox, and then we actually cut the nerve. And it appeared to be safe. We did see instances of orthostasis in patients that were having some more advanced structural disease that didn't like a reduction of preload, because that's all it is. It's a preload reduction. There's no magic to it. And we then embarked on, or there was a company called Axon Therapies actually embarked on developing a catheter. And that catheter is actually referred to as SAVM, splanchnic ablation for volume management. And so that catheter was also tested in single arm investigation. So we know it burns the nerve. It's safe. It's actually relatively easy to do. As a matter of fact, I do the procedure myself. So it's not an IC or EP only procedure, which is one of the nice things. But we've never done RCT. We've never done randomized controlled study. So that's what the Rebalance trial is. It was intended to be a feasibility study to see, well, can we actually do that across 18 centers? Because so far we've done only one or two centers, not more, across the world, Europe and US. So can you do it in multiple centers? Can it be done by a mix of providers, EP, IC, and heart failure? And can we identify patients that respond or not respond to it? Will everybody respond to the therapy? Well, we enrolled little old ladies and young obese men. Let's be very clear. There's no drug or device that probably works in both the same way. And you, of course, would argue maybe the SGLT2s would do some other drugs, probably in very large numbers. But in small numbers, you probably will have to define and refine the physiology a lot more clearer. So we enrolled all of them. Because I do not pretend, and neither did the PI who sent you Shah, that we know who will work it. I cannot tell by looking at a human being if he or she will be a shifter, the squeezer or not. So that's the premise of the trial.
Super. So I have two conceptual questions for you. So first is, you talk about leading up to a worsening heart failure episode, that you could have either this mechanism of volume expansion or volume redistribution. Yet when we have patients who present for worsening heart failure, most are able to feel better with simply intravenous diuretics. Mm-hmm. So how is that cohort of people who have volume distribution as their mechanism, how are they improving with IV diuretics?
I love that question. Actually, because, I don't know, intentionally or unintentionally, you've involved Steve's research into it. Steve did a study at Duke Well, within the first hours of administering IV diuretics, no matter which question you ask, essentially everybody improved quickly. The reality is IV Lasix has also vasodilatory properties that actually act before the diuretic properties. People feel short of breath before they lost the first 100 cc's of volume. That's a known fact. So the vasodilatory effect is there. I think you're going to ask me, well, is this black and white? You have either or no. I mean, I'm making physiology way too easy, of course, here. I think it's going to be a big mix between those two, but I do think there will be extremes. And I'm going to give you an example. If you two put a gun to my head and said, which is the shifter? Give me one phenotype. I would say probably the little old lady is what I would have expected. The skinny old lady, but not very, very stiff ventricles that would probably much more responsive to fluid stress. How do I know? Those are the ladies that would show up, or gentlemen that would show up to the emergency room, and there's clearly no volume in them. They're short of breath and have elevated neck pains. What am I going to diurese in this lady and gentleman, right? So that's a shifter, as opposed to young, 40-year-old obese HFpEF, 20 liters that accumulate over weeks. Maybe there's a shifting component, but clearly that is a volume retention concept going on as well.
Perfect. And then the second conceptual question is a broader question before we jump into the trial, is that this is a patient population that traditionally we haven't been very aggressive about pursuing device-based options. Mm-hmm. HFpEF is a condition we largely manage based on comorbidities and selective pharmacotherapies. So what do you think the patient acceptance of this type of approach for targeting improvements in exercise capacity or functional status?
Well, you know, I think obviously we had you guys talk and publish a lot on this. Is like there's a lot of medication that in HFpEF but GDMT works that can be translated also to HFpEF. I mean, we're talking about Entresto and SGLT2s. They're translatable. They make an impact. They don't make an impact on quality of life, functional capacity, much more so on hospitalizations. Having said that, the unmet need is massive. In HFpEF, it's obscenely massive. HFpEF is 60% of the population now. It's 75% of the population in 10 years from now. It's going to be 80% in another 30 years. So I think the bucket is large enough to where there will be people with residual shortness of breath. And you put Ozempic into the, or you put GLP-1 RAs into it, and they have lost weight. They're still symptomatic, class 3 symptoms. There'll be thousands and thousands, if not millions of people will still be eligible or could consider a one-time procedure. If that to work, of course, the data has to show it first. The beauty about denervating the spinal nerve, it's a one-time procedure as opposed to, you know, maybe a pacemaker, defibrillator type of structure, something that goes into the body, stays, but no additional exposure to risk, I hope.
Gotcha. No, that's a great explanation. I think you're right, too. Like, the bar is lower in HFpEF, 100%. Essentially, for novel therapies and with limited treatment options, although we do have the SGLT2 inhibitors, as you mentioned. Now, let's get to the chase. So walk me through the design of this trial. And again, sham controlled, big credit to you guys for doing that and everything. But can you walk us through the design?
So one of the key premises is that, at some point we'll have to do a pivotal trial, a large 500, 600, 700 patient trial that's going to be randomized. But we knew that, first of all, when we expose the therapy now to 18 centers, we need to do some open label study. So everybody in the beginning had 1 to 2 practice cases per center. We ended up having 26 patients with open label. So you patient you, physician you. That data was just there to calibrate. We did not change inclusion or exclusion criteria based on that going forward. Then we randomized. And the in order to get on a table and qualify before we performed the ablation procedure was you had to exercise on an exercise bike supine. We wanted to do it upright, but we couldn't find enough centers to go upright, so we went supine. Why? We'd want to have that wedge pressure gradient 25 to have an undoubtful diagnosis of HFpEF because the inclusion criteria were obscenely broad. As a matter of fact, the broadest inclusion criteria in any device trial in HFpEF, period. You just had to have either hospitalization for heart failure, either diuretic exposure IV, or an escalation orally, or an initiation of an SGLT2 and or MRA, and or you had an elevated NT-proBNP greater than 150, I believe. You met one of those, you're in with an ejection fraction greater than 50. We ruled out people with orthostatic hypertension because we knew we were going to drop preload. That's a fact. And then we took those patients, exercised them, and enrolled them. After the open label randomized 1-to-1, with the primary endpoint being a change in wedge pressure with legs up and with 20 watts exercise, patients did proceed to exercise all the way to self-limited peak wedge. So whenever they felt they could stop or go to, then we had them stop at that time point. So that was measured as well. And that was compared from baseline to 1 month. And then was a follow-up visit 3, 6, and 12 months with crossover at 12 months. The patient did not get the procedure. They got unblinded at that time point.
Gotcha. And then, so what do the patients look like, the actual baseline characteristics, like including like background medical therapy?
Yeah, so the background medical therapy is probably going to be one of the better ones you have seen. The MRA and SGLT2 use is in both cases around 50, a greater percent in both study arms. It was well-balanced. It was a predominantly female population with, I believe, 70% of females. It was predominantly white, so it was 90% white, but 70% female. 18 centers, you know, in one of those was actually outside of the U.S. and Europe. And we had NT-proBNP of around 250 to 300 across both arms, and high burden of comorbidity, of course, because the average age was, if I'm not mistaken, in the 70s. So, you know, in an elderly population, a lot of comorbidities, not very sick based on NT-proBNP because that was not a mandatory inclusion criterion. That's the baseline.
No, so great.
And the peak wedge was in the range of 36, 37 peak wedge in these patients. Yes. So it's real high wedge, real HFpEF from that standpoint.
The drum roll, tell us about the results.
So before I tell the results, I think, again, it's important to reiterate the objectives. You know, we were hoping to have a slam dunk, everybody benefit. But that would assume that everybody has a shifting mechanism. While that is ideal to assume that, it was unrealistic. Let's talk about the phenotypes. It's unrealistic that everybody has a shifted phenotype. So the intent was to look for subgroups that would respond. And in a total cohort of patients of 90 randomized patients with 44 in one and 46 in the other, there was no statistically significant difference in the exercise wedge with legs up or 20 watts combined. The secondary clinical endpoints was KCCQ, no difference at 6 and 12 months. 6-minute walk, there's a trend towards higher 6-minute walk distance with an additional 10 meters or so gained at the 6 and 12 month mark in the treatment arm. And then an NT-proBNP was going up in the sham, going down in the treat, but not meeting statistical significance, all rated on P of even 0.01. So that's the primary analysis. As interesting additional data point is that we tracked intentionally was medication changes. In the treatment arm compared to the sham arm, so I'll start with the sham arm had 2 times as many diuretic up titration or initiation or GDMT initiation or up titration and follow up through 12 months compared to the treatment. Twice. We also looked at the timeliness of this event. There were about 40 additional unscheduled visits and follow up in sham, more than in a treat arm, during which an initiation occurred. So those were not elective initiations, so were unscheduled. We did not account for them as being an endpoint event. They were not accounted as a heart failure event or ED visit. Equivalent, maybe mistaken or not, but certainly something we learned, but we tracked. So now the key question is, so which of those are actually the ones that benefited? So we use something called Z-score. Z-score has been used before. You're probably very familiar with that. A Z-score allows to homogenize the result across different clinical endpoints. So we used KCQ, 6-minute walk, the NT-proBNP, and the wedge. So all of the primary and secondary endpoints, and homogenized them, standardized them to the same mean, and then looked at predictors. And we put all the predictors that we could, you know, sort of had clinical stress and echo variables. And important, we considered stress, not only supine stress, that's our exercise study, but also just upright standing. That was a predetermined safety test for us because we didn't want to have orthostatic patients because we would not want to drop the preload in them more. But we also had people that was considered for us a stress because if you stand up and you can't augment or maintain your blood pressure, it might be a bad thing. So included, and what we found is that the predictors were fourfold. There were 4 of them. One, if you exercise on a supine bike and you did not augment your cardiac output, you just maintained what you had, which is terrible. I exercise for a living, he knows, he refers. If you can't augment your cardiac output with exercise, supine, you got a problem. You got a big problem. You have HFpEF and another big problem. These people didn't benefit. They saw no benefit with treatment. You augmented cardiac output, you saw benefit. You augmented your heart rate, you saw benefit. If you didn't augment your heart rate, chronotropic insufficient, well, maybe that was your problem. Maybe you need a pacemaker. You might not need an actual preload reduction. So chronotropic insufficiency, no benefit. Chronotropic insufficiency, benefit. 2. 3 was if you stood up from supine to standing, we measured something called pulse pressure, which is systolic minus diastolic. Very simple. If that pulse pressure widened or remained the same, which is a surrogate of stroke volume changes. So if you stood up and you maintained your stroke volume or you increased it, it's physiological. you did well with treatment. If you dropped your stroke volume standing, you preload sensitive, so to say, you dropped your preload, you don't want to give those people treatment, they didn't benefit. And the last but not least is E over A, which is a marker of diastolic dysfunction. If E over A was low, below 2, you benefited from treatment. So those were not very stiff people. If you had a very high E over A, so you're very stiff, you didn't see the benefit of treatment. So if you put it all together, we know we take the bottle and we take the thumb away from the bottle. We just tell the bottle, stop squeezing so much fluid into the chest. So preload increase. And the people that had concomitant reasons for exertional dyspnea, maybe reasons to go to the hospital, exercise, chronic tropic insufficiency, inability to curb cardiac output, very stiff heart, CVRV dysfunction, other signals that started to shine through but were not coming close to significance, these people don't benefit. So if you ask me now, how often did it occur? It was actually about 50-55% of the population that were responders versus non-responders, which is coincidentally the population that we see with weight loss, because the weight gain pre-hospitalization, about 50% of the population gains weight pre-hospitalization together with pressure changes, and 50% of the population does not gain weight in the setting of pressure elevation pre-hospitalization. So maybe there's a relationship of that. Maybe it's a little bit more black and white than we thought.
All right, so Murat, you're a friend. You're a friend, so I'm going to push you a little bit here. So
all day, every day.
You have a 90-patient trial.
Yeah.
And you've identified 4 responder groups, presumably with testing a large number of subgroups.
Yeah.
Overall. So that greatly amplifies the number of hypotheses that you're testing. And so there's a high chance for false discovery here, that one of these signals, while you have beautiful explanations for them, might be a false signal.
100%.
And so how do we move forward? And do we follow these phenotypes as the approach for subsequent trials, subsequent studies?
So actually, this is a secondary analysis. Take it all with a grain of salt. I mean, I'm talking to big time trialists. We will not make up that this is the holy grail. This is a secondary analysis. It's hypothesis generating. It makes sense according to the mechanism. We didn't do orthostatic testing for fun. One of the metrics comes, so we didn't exercise them for fun. Those metrics are coming through and shining through. The key answer to what you're saying is, because we cannot tell with guarantee, we're going to have to do a confirmatory study. So it's very, very, very likely that the next study will be confirmatory study to repeat what we just showed you as variables. But now we're only going to stick to responders. Because in reality is, and again, that similarly has been seen in reduced LAP. That's interior shunt study by the company called Corvia. Sanjeev Shah was a PI on that. They actually went and had a positive phase 2 study. Similar, ours is a phase 2 study. There was positive, maybe unluckily for them, because they went positive. Actually, very little adjustment happened for the subsequent pivotal trial in the INE criteria, inclusion-exclusion criteria. And they had a neutral trial. And then in Powell's talk, and now in a 600-patient study, found out that there were actually groups that might have identified. And actually what has not been shown is, I don't even know if you retrospectively could have identified that group even in the first study, right? So the intent was that this study was upsized intentionally once we saw the reduced LAP2 results published at THT in 2022, with the intent that, okay, let's take an extra step back. Let's make this extra big, of course, more expensive, and just get the answer right up front. And then the confirmatory study will be needed to make sure that before we embark on a large outcomes trial, looking now at endpoints, hard clinical endpoints, let's make sure we got our population right. And I think you would probably ask me, well, are we going to now exercise everybody and stand up everybody and do like all, complex testing of them? We will have to identify in that confirmatory study how we can more comprehensively test them without having to poke them with catheters. I mean, I would like to avoid exercise testing, of course.
I want to hog the questions and ask you one other about the learning curve associated with novel procedures.
Okay.
And so you have this very interesting part of the design in which you have these run-ins. But during the trial, operators that have multiple randomized patients may learn.
Yeah.
And so is there any signal towards that?
No. So as a matter of fact, the run-in phase had actually, from an outcome standpoint, selected totally artificially a slightly more responder population. The responder population looks a lot more like a run-in phase. So the outcome is actually better in a run-in phase. I do think that the learning curve might be there, but it's a very, very steep learning curve because the learning curve is about accessing the nerve, not the ablation procedure itself. Again, I hate to emphasize, I mean, I'm a venous guy. I'm a heart failure guy, just like you guys. I'm in a cath lab. I'm doing the procedure. I can do the procedure. It's not that complicated. The only challenging part sometimes in, you know, 1 out of 5 cases is that in order to access, let me go through procedures. Groin, it's currently groin access, will be neck access in the next study. You're going to go into the azygos vein. The azygos vein is accessed by the EPs for the azygos coil on a regular basis. You go, that is one of the tricky spots because you have to take a curve. It takes a minute now for me because I've done it 30 times or more. You go in there, and if you go down the azygos, you can now branch into the one intercostal. So you ablate on 2 levels, T11, T10. That requires now coronary wire skills and multiple catheter exchange. So you have those things in, EP and ICs, easy for them. Heart failure, of course, I had to learn it with my partner who is an interventional cardiologist. They had me to teach you those skills, but it is learnable, which is why maybe I like your question so much. That is the exciting part. You know, heart failure is hungry for device procedure they can do themselves, to own the space, to be able to offer something that patients sells. I mean, I already do cardiac, so I would like to do other things. That might be one of those things that's easy enough to do, you know, without throwing shade on other device therapies. Bring them all in, but, you know, I cannot do most device-based therapies because I'm not a trained surgeon or electrophysiologist, so it would be nice to do something myself.
Well, that was super interesting findings, Murat, and honestly, one of the things, too, to highlight that the benefit of a sham-controlled trial for really giving us robust data, because, you know, we have your Roland, you know, study that you published as well, so really a big lesson, I think, for the importance of sham control in device-based trials, and also just big credit to you guys for actually, you know, doing the trial. Now you have interesting subgroup findings, and hopefully that'll lead to some productive next steps for the field. But anyway, I just really want to thank everyone for tuning in to this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. I really want to thank our guest, Dr. Murat Fodim. And you can see this episode and all the others of Don't Miss a Beat on hcplive.com, Apple, Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. I'll repeat that at the end. But anyway, we're done. I'll do the end over again. Okay. So I really want to thank everyone for tuning in to this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. Special thank you to my guest, our guest, Dr. Murat Fodim from Duke and the Duke Clinical Research Institute. For all episodes of Don't Miss a Beat, including this one, you can tune in on hcplive.com, or their podcast is also available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks very much, and we're going to enjoy the rest of the HFSA meeting.